Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to Anna Lyons and Louise Winter. Anna is an end-of-life doula supporting those with life-limiting illnesses up to their final moments, whilst Louise is a funeral director and believes strongly that if done right, they can be transformative and cathartic experiences. Well, Louise and Anna have written a book. It's We All Know How This Ends, Lessons About Life and Living from Working with Death and Dying. And it draws on their vast professional experience dealing with people in some of the most crucial moments in their life. Anna and Louise, welcome. We're all going to die, and that is the basic fact of your book. But it's more about living than dying.
It is, absolutely, it is. And we, although we wrote a book about death, we actually discovered at the end that we had written about life much more. We did a word count, and the word death appeared 568 times, but the word life appeared 641 times. Mm. And that was not intentional, but it was just the nature of the work that we do. Death is just the end. Life is what we do the rest of the time.
And Anna, how many people die roughly per day in the world?
Per year in the United Kingdom, about, outside of pandemic times, about 500,000 people die.
And it works out at about 1% of the population globally.
Yes, if that's correct, then yes, my memory of statistics is not amazing. But yes, that sounds about right. I think it's a lot more than we really have any idea. I don't think until coronavirus came about, we had ever seen before how many people die per day, ever.
And I mean, corona has obviously changed the face of death, if you like, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, I'd like to speak about how you both became interested in this subject and what your jobs actually are. So, Anna, what is a doula?
So doula is roughly translated from the Greek word, and it means servant. And I think often people have heard of birth doulas, where people support people through pregnancy and birth. And end-of-life doulas do the same. They support people emotionally and physically at the end of their lives, usually when somebody has been given a life-limiting illness. They also support their friends and family and continue to support people in their grief.
And why was it something that you wanted to do?
My best friend died when I was 17 and I felt very ill prepared. I also felt that things could have been done differently. I'd wanted things to have been done differently and I didn't know how to make that happen. I didn't know how. I felt like we could only do what we were told we could do. And so pretty much from the age of 17, I knew that I wanted to work at end of life with people.
And how about you, Louise? How did you get into being a funeral director?
Well, I'd never even been to a funeral until I was 26. That was my first experience of someone dying, of someone being dead, and my first experience of a funeral. It was my granddad's funeral, and it took place in a crematorium in the north of England, near Yorkshire. And it was just a very standard funeral that lasted about 20 minutes at the crematorium. And I really started to think, what are we doing here? I could tell that the funeral was really important, but I wasn't convinced that the way we were doing it really honoured quite how important it was. And so I ended up leaving my career and exploring the world of funerals whilst asking lots of questions along the way. Why do we have funerals? Should we just dismiss them completely? What are funeral directors? What do they even do? Do we need them? Is there a better way of doing funerals moving forwards? And through all of this exploration, I decided that I wanted to become a funeral director myself and launch a funeral service which I felt was relevant to the times in which we live.
And what does a funeral director do?
So very simply, a funeral director guides family and friends through what to do after someone has died. So taking care of the person that's died, preparing them for their coffin, ordering the coffin, sometimes making the coffin, guiding the family through the funeral arrangements and being there on the day to help it all go smoothly, hopefully.
I mean, I was horrified when my mother died fairly recently about how many euphemisms we use all of the time, this kind of, you know, passed on, gone to a better place, resting at peace now and all the rest of it. And it just seems, particularly in the Western world, that when we do talk about death and we try to avoid it as much as we can, but when we do, it's couched in terms like this. Anna, why is that? Why do we not confront this head on? And why do we not say the words, they have died, rather than, you know, I don't know, gone to heaven?
I think it's our discomfort with it. It's this idea we're constantly told that death and dying are the last taboos. They're things that we can't talk about. People don't want to talk about them. I don't believe this is true, but I think it sends out a message that those words are terrifying. And I think that people are so uncomfortable that they feel that it kind of makes it a little bit easier to say it differently or to not use the actual words. And I found in my whole career that actually it's just more confusing, especially when you're talking to children. You know, when you say to a child somebody's passed on or they've gone to sleep, the assumption is, well, they don't know what passed on means for a start. But when you tell them that they've gone to sleep, they expect them to wake up again. I think it's very difficult to really understand what's happened when we don't use the correct words.
Yes. Your book is structured beautifully. So you've got a number of different sections, but you also have lots of contributions from other people, people who have been through some of the things that you describe. And they all give us five facts about whatever that particular subject is. I want just to start with what five things actually is. Tell us about that.
So Louise and I together run a project called Life, Death, Whatever, and we have lots of sort of little projects within that, and Five Things is one of those. And we were just sitting around my kitchen table one Saturday night thinking about all of the people that contact us with their incredible stories, and we wanted to find a way to share those stories, but also to share what people have learned, because grief and difficult things can be very, very isolating. And actually knowing that somebody has been through something similar or hearing about other people's experiences can be really, really helpful, not only for the person sharing them, but for other people listening. And so Five Things was born out of wanting to be able to help people, wanting to create a resource and wanting to find a platform where we could share other people's stories.
Mm. In your chapter on death and dying, there are many different sections in it. And you talk about all sorts of things about what to do when you're first diagnosed, how to get the most from your consultations with your doctor and specialist, all these really, really practical pieces of advice. You also talk about death admin. And one of the areas that you investigate is your digital admin and what that means for your personal archive and how to look after that. Tell us more, Anna.
You know, now everything's online. It's really, really important that you think about what you want to happen. What do you want to happen to your Twitter account or your Instagram account or your Facebook? There are, I think you can memorialize them, but giving people the passwords, giving someone you trust access to them so that when something happens to you or if you die, they're able to sort that out for you. And I think it's something that people haven't really considered. We've got this digital life now, but actually what happens to that digital life after we die and on what do we want to do with it? Elaine Casket has written a Five Things for us specifically about that. And she also wrote a book about it. I think it's a really fascinating topic that will only sort of get more and more relevant.
So you address this, doing your death admin. You also talk about making funeral arrangements in advance, different places to die and how this might happen. What actually happens, though, when somebody dies? What should we expect? And is it good to prepare ourselves to try and imagine this? And perhaps, I don't know, even do your mourning in advance?
I don't think it's possible to do your mourning in advance. I think there's something called anticipatory grief that we talk about quite a lot in the book, and it's where we sort of go through the process of imagining what life will be like when somebody intrinsic to us has died, or indeed when we've died ourselves. We can grieve anticipatory, we can grieve in an anticipatory way for ourselves as well. I don't think it's possible to mourn in advance, though.
Tell us what death looks like.
That's such a difficult question, because it looks different for everybody. It also looks different depending on who you're looking at. Looking at somebody you love having died looks very, very different to looking at a stranger. Death is almost always quite ordinary in the end, and sort of a few things happen. People's bodies shut down very slowly. They spend less time awake and more time asleep. There's very often not this opportunity to say last words, because actually very often somebody has been unconscious for quite a long time before they die. Everybody's death is different. Everybody's death means something different to everyone who's there. So it's a very difficult question.
Mm. Once they have died, what happens next, Louise? I mean, you're often called out in the middle of the night. People want to get bodies out of the way as quickly as possible.
It can be, and again, it depends on the circumstances of the death. If it's been an expected death at home, because someone maybe has been living with a life-limiting illness and has come to the end, then it doesn't have to be an emergency, providing that the doctors have signed off all the correct paperwork and that there are no suspicious circumstances. It's perfectly fine for the person to stay at home for a bit longer. You can light candles, you can play favourite music, you can just take your time to be with the person before calling the funeral director, if you want to call a funeral director at all, because actually in the UK you don't need to work with a funeral director if you don't want to. You can take care of all the arrangements yourself. If it happens in a hospital or it's an emergency situation, then it's slightly different. The coroner may be involved if it's an unexpected death, and there might be a post-mortem and investigations might take place. But the main thing is just to take your time. In most cases, death is not an emergency. And I think I've seen with the people that I've supported that if they allow themselves to just sit with the person, be with them, allow the reality of the person being dead to be very present, it can make all the difference moving forward.
So why do we have funerals? Why are they important? And why are they so expensive?
Oh, well, these are the questions I've been asking myself over the last few years, and hopefully some of the answers are in the book. But I think funerals are intrinsic to who we are as humans. We have always had funerals, as far as I know. It's been a very important part of the nature of being alive, that when one of us dies, we want to find a way to acknowledge that. I think funerals are an opportunity for everyone to come together, to support each other, to find community within the loss, to be able to acknowledge what's happened in order to be able to find a way forward without that person. It's also an opportunity to find out more about the person who's died, to figure out what they meant to other people and allow ourselves to grieve. I think people often describe funerals as closure and that they were annoyed by the funeral because it didn't provide closure. But I actually think funerals don't provide closure. That's not what they're for. They are there as a marking point along the journey. But it's usually after the funeral has taken place that grief really begins. Mm. Once all the chaos of arranging a funeral and all the paperwork that needs to be done and all of the ordering sandwiches in normal times when we don't have COVID, that hasn't been happening so much anymore. But once all of that is completed, that's when we can sit down with the reality of the loss and really begin living with it.
Well, you have an amazing chapter about grief and what it is and how it affects the brain. Can you unpick that for us?
Yes. So when we're grieving, our brain works very differently. I often work with highly competent, really intelligent people who are very switched on and have their lives together. But when they're grieving, feel like they can't do anything. Regardless of how competent we are in life, grief does something to our brain and means that we can shut down, we can lose our memory, it can be very difficult to just do the most basic of tasks. Our just everyday functioning can go out the window when we're grieving, and that makes it really difficult to be able to face the world.
I mean, there's the very famous Elizabeth Kubler-Ross book, and she talks about five stages of grief. I think the book was on death and dying. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression and acceptance. Is that something that we still subscribe to?
No. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote that book specifically, or that particular section specifically, about people going through stages of grieving their life when they'd been diagnosed with a life-limiting illness. It was never about the grief that we feel after somebody dies. It was written specifically about the grief of your life coming to an end.
And that's, in fact, something that you address there. You do talk about how to come to terms with the fact that you yourself have a life-limiting illness and how to support a friend or a relative that is in that position.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really important thing to try to do. But also one of the things that we wanted to get across, it can be quite dangerous to tell people that there are five stages, that they will feel a certain way, that they will feel a certain thing at a certain time. And actually, that's not the case at all. Grief is unique. In fact, Lois Tonkin, who was an academic who wrote a huge amount about grief, and she very sadly died last year, she described grief as being as unique as a fingerprint. Everybody experiences it completely differently. And all of the things that we feel when we're grieving are perfectly normal.
I mean, you sum all this up at the end of the book. You wonderfully just put everything in kind of numbered form and just tell us how to deal with it. You also have a really incredibly helpful table about what to say and what not to say, and how it's not about you, it's about them. Give us some examples of that.
We heard so many stories from the people that we worked with about whatever it was they were facing, whether it was they'd had some terrible news about their cancer diagnosis or their partner had died and people were crossing the road to avoid speaking to them. We just keep hearing these stories of how people don't feel supported when they're going through something really difficult, or stories about all the unhelpful things that people have said. And what we wanted to do was give people an idea of some of the helpful things that can be said when we're facing something difficult. I know previously, before I ever worked in this environment, you know, if someone had been through something really difficult at work, it was really tough to know what to say to them, you know, when they came back and standing at the water cooler with them, kind of not knowing. And often it's easy just to not say anything at all. So we just wanted to come up with a few phrases which can really help people to know what to say. And it's things like, this is so unfair and I'm so, so sorry. I don't know what to say, but I want you to know that I'm here for you. Another one is just saying, I can be here for you. I can just sit here and listen, or I can distract you. We can watch funny films, whatever it is you prefer. And I think by being a bit more open and putting ourselves forward and not sort of either crossing the street and running away from it, or just coming out with a platitude that actually can often be quite offensive, we can really be a bit more consistent for people and really show up for them at their time of need.
Mm. You also include some beautiful poetry, just really wonderful examples of sort of mourning poetry. And of course, that's very helpful when trying to plan an order of service, which is something else that you give us a practical guide to. Death has become ever more present for all of us now because of the pandemic. Anna, how has coronavirus changed the nature of death?
Oh, that's a really big question. I think it has infiltrated our lives in ways that it had never done before. You would have to actively go out of your way to ignore death at the moment. Whereas I think pre-coronavirus, you would have had to go out of your way to have sort of death and dying at the forefront of your life. I think it's become our everyday realities. We're faced with death tolls every single day and have been for 365 days. You know, I think it's made people more frightened, but I also think it's made people want to talk about it as well.
Finally, I wonder, and I mean, it's very difficult, I know, to ask you to sum it up in this way, but as you said at the beginning, this is ultimately a book about life. And so when looking at death, what is it that we should be keeping uppermost in our minds?
I think the bit that so often I think about over and over again is that death is a tiny, tiny part of this wonderful, incredible thing that we call life. When people describe someone as dying, the actual dying process is incredibly short, and you live right up until the point that you die. And it just feels so important that we understand that life is finite, so that we can live that one life of ours as brilliantly and as well as we possibly can.
When it ends, we have this fantastic resource to help us through it. Anna Lyons and Louise Winter, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much for having us.
Anna and Louise's book is called We All Know How This Ends, Lessons About Life and Living from Working with Death and Dying, and it's published by Greentree. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to producer Nora Hull and researcher Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.